Thank you.
Studying together. Looking
the
forward to it.
Best place to be.
It's
not bad. Not bad. Now, you remember to just recapitulate a little bit. We are studying about Kesef. There were three ways to perform the Kiddushin, to create the change of status of Kiddushin. It was Kesef, Shtar, and Bi'ah. And the first one was Kesef. We saw that right at the beginning of the Gemara, that the Gemara explained that Kesef was a value, a central form of kinyan, of acquisition, of change of status, and that we learn from the dealings of Abraham with Ephron the Hittite. Okay, now we have been studying the subject now of Kesef as the key participant in the kinyan, the key player in the kinyan. And what we read last time was something a little bit strange, and that is that Kesef is actually effective even if it is given conditionally as part of something else, some transaction, if you need to have an acquisition. Even a conditional acquisition is a real acquisition, such as we saw that, this is Rava, we saw that in the laws of the Etrog. Etrog. You have to own the Etrog that you have. All right? V'lak ulakachtem lachem pri etz hadar. You shall take for yourselves the fruit of a hadar tree, which we understand to be the Etrog. Somebody says to you, I'm giving you this Etrog, and after you make the bracha on the Etrog, please return it to me. That's a conditional gift. A gift is a gift. But the question was, is a conditional gift enough ownership so that we can consider it to be really ownership? Because if we say you have to own the Etrog, do you own it or you don't own it? If somebody gives it to you conditionally. If they give it to you unconditionally, it's not a question. Because a gift is certainly something that we understand is a valid form of ownership. Come to own something if somebody gives you a gift. Question is, if they give you a conditional gift, is it possible? The strange answer was, yes, it is possible. And in fact, even though we may not do it that way, if it's done that way, it's okay. It's okay. However, there were a variety of different types of acquisition that were mentioned in the Baraita, and only one of them is not qualified, and that is kiddushin beisha. All right, to give kiddushin for a woman, you cannot do that with a conditional gift. You cannot do it with a conditional gift, because in effect, a conditional gift turns into what we call chalipin. Chalipin was a form of acquisition which is not a transfer, a clear transfer of property, but a totally symbolic transfer of property. And then we gave the example of the Kinyan Sudar, which is the common one in the Halacha. That is where you hold one half of the handkerchief, I hold one, the other half of the handkerchief, you pull toward you, I pull toward you, and there's a Kinyan. Something has changed status as a result of that. In theory, what has happened is that you've taken the handkerchief, that's my handkerchief, and I've given it to you as a present. Right? You then give it back to me in order to make the kinyan. The way you do that symbolically is you just take the handkerchief and you pull it from two sides. That's the way it's actually done. But that's called chalipin. That's chalipin. And the question is, can you marry a woman with chalipin? Can you use kinyan sudar? Can you have a handkerchief? And under the chuppah, she holds one half of the handkerchief, you hold the other half of the handkerchief, and you both pull, and could they say, mikudeshet?
No.
Lo mikudeshet. Lo mikudeshet. Because a woman... Because to the extent that this is simply a transaction that has nothing passing hands, It's like a barter transaction in a way, and that we do with objects, but women are not objects. So you can't do that. You can't do that in the circumstance. Instead, you have to have a real transaction that takes place. It has to be a real transaction. So even though we saw that in theory this might be possible, the one exception in the laws of Kinyanim was the exception of Kiddushin. Okay? So we are sort of seeing to ourselves, we had seen earlier on in the Gemara, that we learned that when you give the kesef, you have to give it with a certain formula. And then we saw that it wasn't quite as strict as we thought it was going to be. Yes, you have to give it with a certain formula. That is to say, if you give it with another formula that mixes things up and nobody's sure what the result of that formula is, it's no good. But if you even gave the kiddushin with no formula, but it was clear to all the parties concerned what the purpose of this transaction was, that you were giving something of value from the hands of the groom to the bride, and that he knew and she knew, and there was no question about what was going on, mikudeshet. Right, that's kosher. So the interesting thing was that while we started out assuming that this had to be highly structured in order for it to be understood, it ends up almost the opposite. It doesn't have to be highly structured. It can be unstructured. You have to say a certain thing. Except, if you don't say anything, it could also be okay. But it has to be okay only in a circumstance where it's very clear. So we had this experience of assuming beforehand that the thing has got to be exactly as it's supposed to be. And when we finally got to the end of it, we saw it ain't like that at all. Now, we're dealing with another aspect of it. We saw that he has to give her something. He has to give her something. We last time entertained whether he actually has to give her something, or whether even if she were to gain some benefit that he, as a result of what he sort of gave to her, whether that would be enough. Because benefit is also shaveh kesef. It's worth dollars. It's worth money. Okay? So the question was, for example, first thing was, if she has a loan from him, and he says to her, I already gave you the loan, we'll cancel some of this loan. That's definitely a benefit to her. Was it kosher? Was mikudeshet? Lo mikudeshet, not kosher. Why? Was it because it was not a benefit? No, two potential problems here. The first problem is that, in a way, nothing's happened. He hasn't given anything, or he hasn't authorized anything to be given. Even if theoretically he doesn't have to give anything, this is already something that happened before. There's a before that to this. Then we said, well, there was a possibility that she could be that there's some kind of benefit that could be conferred to her. But then we ran into another problem. We said, oh, that could be kiddushin. We might actually think that that was enough because conferring a benefit on her is shava kesef. It's worth something. And maybe that's good enough. But we said, no, there was another problem. The problem was the prohibition against interest. If he changes the terms of a loan favorably to her, while that isn't really interest, it in effect is almost that. And because it's almost that, because it has shades of that, we prohibit it. Not because, however, it's not the conferral of some benefit. And not because the conferral of a benefit might not make kiddushin. It might actually make kiddushin. But in this circumstance, we had to disqualify it because it was too much like interest.
Because the intent was kosher.
Well, the intent was perfectly kosher.
The intent was to confer interest.
Well, it wasn't really. It wasn't really. The intent was to marry her. That's why he really wanted to do it. And if she had a loan that was going to be for 3 years, and he says, well, you could pay me back the loan in 1 year. She just gained the benefit from that. That's what we read in the Gemara. She gained the benefit. She gained 2 more years of the use of money, right, without having to pay for it. That's a benefit. That's a real benefit. Problem is, it's too much like interest. Okay? Interest. Too much like interest. Right? So the Gemara had to disqualify it. Okay? Now, we are on 6b3. The protagonist here is Rava. I ask you to keep in mind again that you're dealing with somebody in the beginning of the 4th century in Babylonia. So that in effect we are seeing the development of the law already a good 125 years after the finishing of the Mishnah. Mishnah is 200. Dealing roughly 325, we're no longer in the land of Israel, we're in Babylonia. Babylonia has a complicated economy. The whole sophistication of economy is rather great, which I'm sure is probably true in the land of Israel too, but we just don't have all that evidence. We have a lot of evidence here in Babylonia. Okay, now we're on 6b3, the right-hand side, the last paragraph. Rava sets up a few additional ways that you can actually perform Kiddushin. Now, the simplest way, remember the simplest way, is he gives her something worth shtei prutot, 2 prutot, 2 cents. That's basically what has to happen. So Rava says, yes, that's basically what happens. But what happens if? Now, let's see the ifs. Amar Rava, Rava says, Tain mane liploni. The woman suggests to the man, give a mane. A mane is 10 silver dinars. That's a lot more than 2 prutot. That's a whale of a lot of money. So she says to the guy, all right, give a mane. Give this $100, as it were, to so-and-so. Ve'ekadesh lecha. And I will become your wife. And I will become your wife. Mikudeshet midin aref. This is a kosher kiddushin because of the law of guarantorship. Do you believe this? Guarantee or guarantorship. I don't know if that's a real word.
That's a different law?
That has nothing to do with this at all, except that it's very relevant.
but it's a separate... Like,
it had nothing to do with the laws of marriage. It's business law. We'll get to it in a moment to see what it is. What somebody becomes a guarantor of a loan. Okay?
Who is she suggesting that he give the money to?
Mr. Joe, you. Okay, a brother, a sister, a friend, to a landlord. Okay, give it to my landlord Francis. I want you to give $100 to my landlord Francis.
Pay my rent.
To pay my rent.
Oh, well,
all right, she owes your rent.
She took it already.
All right.
She withdraws from the deal.
All right. So.
But you cannot.
Sir?
Well, they pay $100
for it, maybe. All right. I'm not saying that's the whole rent, but that'll be the $100 of the rent. You'll then expect X dollars less. Okay?
She's negotiating. Yeah.
Francis, you want more or you want less? More?
What I charge my students.
What do you charge?
$600 a month.
Deal. $600. $600. Okay.
How many rooms?
She says. Then, give Francis $600.
You're married.
Give Francis $600. And as a result of that, you can marry me. The question is: is this any kind of a kiddushin? And the Gemara says, mikudeshet.
She said it to him.
Can you understand this? First of all, she says it to him. We learn that he has to say it to her. Secondly, he has to give her something. What does he give? He gives something. He doesn't give anything. Oh, yes, no, he does. He gives the money to Francis. Francis doesn't marry him. The woman marries him. The other woman marries him. All right?
It's for her benefit.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah, but how do I get the money then?
Francis, don't worry so much. Don't worry so much.
Does this have to do with guaranteeing a loan?
All right. So, let's take this apart and see what's going on here. Okay? The reference is made, Mekudeshet midin arev. The woman becomes betrothed to him through the principle of the guarantor. Now here the Gemara will explain to us what this principle is. Arev lav ala lav afal gav delomate hana alia de kamash mishab idnavshe. Excuse me. Even though he does not personally receive the benefit of the money lent, the guy doesn't receive the guarantor. A guarantor doesn't receive, in the general laws, let's say.
The guarantor is the groom in this instance?
No, wait, forget about what it is.
Oh,
let's just talk in general. Because now we're just looking in general at the law of a guarantor. Law of a guarantor, somebody, a guarantor says, if you loan my friend $100, I'll guarantee that I'll pay it back.
It's a subprime loan.
Okay. A subprime loan? Well, maybe.
Well, it's related to some sense. It is a subprime loan.
Is that related to the credit loan?
Let's get this one straight first. Let's get this one. Let's get this straight first.
No, we're not a credit swap yet.
Let's get this straight as it is here. Then you can tell me whether it's analogous to anything else. So there's a loan between two people, and the guarantor says, I guarantee this. It's a very interesting reality if a guarantor... What does the guarantor get out of this? Guarantor doesn't get any money.
No, the guarantee says I'll pay back in case you don't get
it. Yeah, but
back.
The guarantor gets nothing. The guarantor, for whatever reason, decides that he wants this thing to happen. Maybe he gets a level of satisfaction out of it. Maybe he's happy that he's able to provide this service to someone else.
Maybe
he has a vested interest in the long-term relationship that's being developed here. There are a variety of possibilities here. However, he doesn't get, in this transaction, he gets nothing.
No monetary.
He only gets an obligation, as a matter of fact. He's obligated as a result of it. But he's a key player because as a result of his playing in this transaction, the transaction takes place. Without him involved in the transaction, there'd be no transaction. So the very act of being a guarantor creates a kinyan. It creates an acquisition. Without him being the guarantor, there would be no acquisition. With him being the guarantor, there is an acquisition. So that even though it's not the same as an act of acquisition, it really is tantamount. It's a catalyst for the acquisition, because without that, there could be no acquisition. So he's not the direct beneficiary of something, but he makes this thing happen, which is much along the lines of what a kinyan is. A kinyan is that something happens that enables a change of status to take place. If two people want to get married, for example, something has to happen to enable that change of status to take place. Here, something has happened. Money is passed from the hands of one person to another person because of a third person. So that third person, as a guarantor, has a lot of similarity to a kinyan. Okay? The guarantor has a lot of similarity to the kinyan. Right? That's what I've been trying to prove to you. All right? Afal gav de lamate hana aliyah de, even though... Wait, let's see. No, we'll go back a little bit. Lav al avtalama tehana aliyadei kamishabdid nafshei. Even though he does not personally receive the benefit of the money lent, the guarantor doesn't get the money, nonetheless, does he not bind himself to repay if the borrower defaults? All right, so he's like a Kenyan. He causes the whole thing to happen, and in effect, it changes his status as well. He takes upon himself an obligation as a result of that. Okay? Hai I tatanami. Now we see the analogy. This woman as well, the same principle applies to her. Afal gav de la mate han aliyada. Even though she does not personally receive the benefit of the money given, right? Because she's not getting any money here. Remember, she's saying, give Francis the money. She wants to give Francis the money. So she's not getting the money. We assumed she had to get the money. But in fact, she doesn't get the money. She is the one who enables Francis to get the money. Francis, in fact, does get the money. That's a perfectly kosher transaction, and it never would have happened if the bride hadn't said, give Francis the money. So it's in some ways analogous to the guarantor. It's analogous to the guarantor. And the key thing is here, it's actually two things. First of all, we said that the guarantor is analogous to a Kenyan. We've just created a situation with a potential bride, which is analogous to the guarantor. If the guarantor is analogous to the Kenyan, and the bride is analogous to the guarantor, then the bride's transaction is analogous to a Kenyan as well, right? And what we needed was for the bride to be a key player, well, for the bride to be involved in the Kenyan. She has to get something. And in a way, she is getting something. She is getting something, again, the way a guarantor gets something. In this case, of course, Francis is paying her rent, but it could be totally different. She could be getting nothing out of it. She just wants someone else to be able to have a loan, let's say. Okay? And so in a way, she gets maybe the satisfaction of that. She gets the relationship out of it. She gets something out of it. Okay? And of course, here, again, the groom is actually giving something. Remember, we said the groom has to give the bride something. Here we have two other pieces that entered into it. First of all, the bride says to the groom, give. Right? So in a way, she has a level of motivation or a level of involvement here, which is a little bit different than what we're used to. But in a way, it doesn't matter because you're under the chuppah. The bride can say, all right, give me the ring. All right, that doesn't disqualify the whole thing from happening if she says, give me the ring. But he's got to give the ring. She can't give him the ring. He has to give her the ring. All right? So here, in fact, he is giving. He's giving, as it were, the ring. Shaveh kesef, something worth money. The funny thing is, he doesn't give it to her. He gives it to somebody else at her direction. But it's functionally the same thing. In fact, it's functionally the same thing, and therefore, mikudeshet.
I would like to break it and to try to go over something we did last week. Okay. Let's say the guy give her the money, she give it to the plony, to the third party. If he gave her the money as a loan, and she, of course, she need any trust her to pay him back.
Wait, go back. Hold it. Yeah. Go back again. The groom gave the bride money.
Right.
As a loan, okay?
And she's the guarantee, because she will pay him back, correct? Because that's the way a rev is to a loan.
Correct.
It's not for a gift.
Correct.
So instead of giving it to the plony, to the third party, he gives it to her, she gives it to him, to the third party. Then she's not mikudeshet, because on a loan you cannot marry. There is no kiddushin. So why, when you made a shortcut and you pay directly the plony, and she's just the paperwork.
The big thing is because he gives the money.
Gave the money before too.
But that already happened before the transaction.
No. She said to him, I will marry you if you will give a loan to Joe.
Yeah.
and I will guarantee it.
So oh, I will marry, say that, I will marry you if you give the loan to Joe?
Yeah.
Mekudeshet. Okay.
Okay,
that's this case.
So now she said to him like this, I will marry you if you give me the money so I can give it to Joe.
So that I, that's also Mekudeshet.
Well,
but if she,
but that's
no,
a loan that
no,
she wants to give it back.
No, last week
last
we had a different case.
Not Mekudeshet.
Last week we had a case. She gets a loan, having nothing to do with the marriage. It has nothing to do with the marriage.
No, but that's conditioned to the marriage.
If it's conditional to the marriage, then it's different. If she has a loan, they have business relations. He gave her a loan at some point. He says, all right, I'll forgive you part of the loan. That's not okay. That was not okay.
Correct.
Okay? That's the only thing that's not okay. These cases that you just gave me are analogous to what we're reading here, and they're
correct,
okay.
But if I gave, if this guy gave a woman money as a loan to be returned, he cannot marry her on based on that.
If
he
gave,
she say, I will marry you
loan,
if you will
right?
give me the loan.
Well,
this case
we had that
loan.
Case.
This is a gift.
It's no, that's not. That, if she is a rev, guaranteed that's a loan. You don't give a gift and then you have a guarantee.
If he gives her a loan.
It's a loan here. It's not a gift here.
Correct.
Doesn't say that in the
wait.
Text.
No, wait.
No, it's not a loan.
If there
wait, first
is a
all,
rev,
no, no, wait, no, wait a minute. Hold on.
So explicitly, a loan is not Mekudeshet.
A loan, in the case of the loan, was a case where the loan was given ahead of time, before there was any transaction of marriage.
That
is not Mekudeshet.
Correct.
Okay?
Now,
so what other case are you trying to find out here?
Hmm?
Which is
a
the case?
After.
No,
what,
I'm
what,
talking
what
about
is the rule if you get if you say Hareat and you give here's a loan and you'll pay me back the two putot in 6 months? Is that or in a year? Is that?
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that, but that's not what we're talking about. That's all I can tell you.
But that's what Rav is talking about. A loan
what?
Is not does not make for.
Did he say gift?
For acquiring a woman, it's like giving something for anything except in the case of kedushin.
Well, we had the case here where something was given conditionally, right? And the conditional case we didn't allow, not because it wouldn't be a valid transaction, but because it was too much like interest.
Right.
That was the objection to it, okay? So that's the objection. If we can figure out a case where, in fact, the woman functions as a guarantor. That's the case
yeah,
which we
have.
Yeah,
but if it's a guarantee, it's not a gift, it's a loan. When you have a guarantee in a transaction,
correct.
Even though she is the number one facilitator to that
correct.
Transaction,
correct.
If she is a guarantee,
well, it's
that's
worse
a
than
loan. It's not a gift. If
fine.
If you will say, give
correct.
Me a gift, I'll marry you,
that's
I have no problem.
I understand what you're saying. That's correct. You're correct. That is correct. Indeed, when you act as a guarantor, you allow the money to pass from the hands of one person to another. It is a loan. It's not a gift. It's a loan.
Right.
And therefore, the act of being the guarantor here, the whole use of the guarantor is simply to say that this is a key, he's a key player
well,
in making a transaction happen.
Without monetary benefit.
It doesn't, the issue is not whether it's a loan or not, but it happens to be in this case, happens to be. And the key thing is that a third party who gets no direct benefit can be a key player. That's the analogous, the analogy here. Here the woman is a third party, is a key player, okay? And therefore, she's like a guarantor in that way. If you're going to tell me she's exactly like a guarantor, that all the laws of guarantors are exactly the same as this, I wouldn't learn that. I wouldn't go that far. All I can tell you is that there is some form of analogy between the two, even if the two are not completely identical. Okay, so I don't have to press it too far. I don't have to say that everything is the same for marriages as is the case for a guarantor. But if there is some area where there is a similarity between the two, that's all I'm trying to show you. Okay?
It's interesting because then she can say, you know, give me the money and I will transfer it to the plony.
Mm-hmm.
And I
well, she can certainly, she can as long as she gets the money,
but
she can do whatever
she
wants to.
Because that's what we
no,
no.
no
sure.
If she gives her the money, then she's
sure.
Mekudeshet.
She did what she wanted.
She can do whatever she wants with it. That's up to her.
She changed her status a second time.
She could do whatever she wants. Okay? Because it's hers.
Yeah, but you cannot marry on a loan. That's the issue. If he gives her the money.
Well, you're beating a dead horse.
Yeah. it's the word of
the
rev.
Yeah, yeah, because don't the analogy too bad. Here is not, it is, how, is there another circumstance where a person is binds herself or himself without receiving a direct benefit? A guarantor. Forget the fact that it's a loan. It's just you bind yourself, but you're only an indirect beneficiary. She, in this example, is the same.
Right.
She's bound, she binds herself, even though she doesn't get the benefit directly.
Derek.
The fact that he's alone is not that...
That's
not
well,
this
excellent.
Excellent. Do you think this happened? I'm getting emails from
Europe. Let's wait till the next one. We're just getting started. This is the less complicated the possibilities.
Isn't that the woman who was binding herself has made it a precondition for the deal to go through? I will become betrothed to you only if you give the money.
We don't know that.
To the person.
I couldn't tell you because it doesn't say. And it's not necessary for that to be the only that's a precondition. As long as she makes this statement, she says, if you give the money to so-and-so, that's all we know. It's all the Gemara has told us. Okay?
So the concept is of all these illustrations that they existed. Or you think that the rabbis made
it? Let's go a little bit further. Let's go a little bit further because I think you'll see that even initially it's obvious to us that we're beginning to extend the idea of the necessity of a man giving a woman something of value to a limit that we hadn't really contemplated. At least I hadn't contemplated it. I mean, I'm very surprised by this. It never would have ever occurred to me that we would go in that direction, that you could actually make such a transaction without making the transaction. I mean, that's kind of, it's interesting and maybe even amusing, but it's surely also a little bit bizarre to imagine. Right? But maybe, let's keep going on. Hey, Lach. All right, now we have a second possibility. Hey, Lach, Maneh. A man appoints an agent to betroth a woman. Okay?
Agent?
An agent. So the agent is going to act on his behalf. An agent, shlucho shel adam kamoto. A man's agent acts as he does. So, elach maneh. A man appoints an agent to betroth a woman, but the agent uses his own funds. Right? The agent doesn't use my money. I'm marrying a woman. I can understand if the agent takes my money and gives it to the woman that that's a marriage because the agent is carrying my money. No. The agent takes his money. Not my money, but his money. I authorize the agent to act on my behalf. He then takes his own money. What?
Money is fungible.
Maybe that's it. Okay. He takes his own money and he says, if a man appoints an agent to betroth a woman, but the agent uses his own funds to carry out this transaction, saying to her, the agent then says to the woman, take this money and become betrothed to so-and-so, miku deshet midin eved ivri. She be... Kanani. It's a big mistake. She becomes betrothed to the man through the principle of the Canaanite slave's emancipation.
Canaanite slave's emancipation?
Correct. This, I'm sure you were thinking about that before you came here tonight.
Is the money emancipates her?
Nah.
We don't know.
There is as we just had a concept of aref, of a guarantor, and there was some analogy between the guarantor and this fact pattern that we've just read about. There is some analogy between this fact pattern that we have just read and the emancipation of the Canaanite slave. What's the analogy? Well, If a man is a Canaanite slave, he can pay for his own emancipation. The slave owner can say, all right, if I get $1,000, you're free. question is,
where will he get the
$1,000? Because in theory, everything the slave owns is his master's. Right?
Borrowed.
All right? Well, he can't, even if he borrowed it, he has no ability to own anything. If he's borrowed it, the master has borrowed it. Okay? And if the master has borrowed it, then you can't pay the master with his own money, even if it's borrowed money. So that's the theoretical problem here. That's the theoretical problem. Okay? So that the slave, in effect, buys his own emancipation, but there's no way for him to make the purchase. Because while he's a slave, he can't own anything, so he can't give anything. That's the intellectual problem here. We have a conundrum. Right? Wait! Don't tell me you know how to solve this. No one in a million years has solved this problem. It's impossible to solve. All right. So, there is a way to deal with this, though. There is a way to deal with it. Look at, let's see, number 7, maybe? Number 7. The Mishnah later states that a Canaanite slave gains his freedom when a third party pays money to the master on his behalf. That's perfectly reasonable. Somebody else can pay the money to emancipate this slave, for whatever reason. You know, this guy, once he's emancipated, it'll work for the guy, whatever it is. But since the guy, in theory, can't own anything, he can't give anything that's his, so somebody else can, though. All right? Now, if that's the case, although the slave's own money is not used in the kinyan, he nevertheless is the beneficiary of the transaction. So that you can be a beneficiary of a transaction, your status can be changed, even if you are not a direct participant in the actual kinyan of kesef. Mm-hmm. All right? Because the kinyan of kesef is between a third party and the master. All right? Not you, but you're the beneficiary of that.
Rabbi, would there be a document about such a transaction? Because there are three ways that the woman can be
acquired.
Correct.
There might be. And that might be another.
It would obviate the
need for kesef. Right. It may be that there are other ways to do this. But this is one of the ways.
So this is meant as the kesef way.
Exactly. Exactly.
Kesef.
Exactly. Exactly. This is meant as the kesef way. So that since the slave is dealt with as, in effect, as a matter of property. Slave is a matter of property. Property transactions, real property transactions, can take place with kesef, shtar, and some other activity. And we'll see this in a little while. So kesef is one of them. The only question is, well, if kesef is one of them, logically, how does it work? How can it really happen, given our nature of the laws of commercial transactions? How can this transaction actually take place? Since the law tells us that it can, how is it possible?
Through
okay?
the third party.
Okay, through the third party, through the third party. Okay, now let's go back. A man appoints an agent to betroth a woman. So the agent uses his own funds the way the third party pays the slave owner. The third party pays the slave owner, and then the person, somebody benefits from this. Right? Man appoints an agent to betroth the woman. So he gives the money, the man, the agent, gives the money to the
bride.
Correct, to the bride, to the bride, to the bride. And he says, become betrothed to so-and-so. Okay? He's like the third party in the slave transaction. Okay? The whole point is, again, not that these are identical transactions, and not that everything about one is the same as the other, but we do see that a third party can have a piece of the transaction, and there can be an involved party who's the beneficiary of this transaction, who in fact doesn't take part directly in the transaction. Namely, it's not his money. It's simply not his money. It's party number two's money. Just as in the slave transaction, it's not his money, it's party number two's money. Okay? So there's some similarity. So interestingly enough, we now found another situation. We found a situation where even though we say that you have to give them, the husband has to give the wife something of value. You know what? It doesn't have to be that way. Because somebody else can give the wife something of value.
But they don't stand in the ceremony. This is only in the betrothal.
This is the kiddushin. This is the kiddushin. Don't visualize any wedding scenes. This, the possibility of this happening under a chuppah is not great. Never happened any of my weddings. But this is theoretically what we are trying to do is to stretch the limits and see how far these issues go.
Very far away, let's say, mm-hmm. war, something like that, and for whatever reason they want to, you know, before they die, before whatever.
Mm-hmm.
For inheritance, for whatever. I mean, there can be all kinds of extenuating circumstances. You could see someone in there doing
possible.
This for them.
Definitely.
Maybe. I'm trying to figure out extenuating circumstances.
That's correct.
Why
you're absolutely right. That's exactly, you're absolutely right. Okay, let's go a little bit further so that we can see the explanation of this. Eved kanani lav af al gav delaka chaser velo midi hakani nafshi. A Canaanite slave, even though he does not give up anything of his own in the transaction, he doesn't pay a penny. Does he not acquire himself as a free man when others redeem him with their own money? Okay. Hai gavraname, the same holds true for this man when his agent pays on his behalf. Even though he does not give up anything in the Kiddushin transaction, he nevertheless acquires this woman as his wife. All right. So now we see that even though you have to give her money, somebody else can in effect do it.
Well, yeah, I mean... I don't think these are very good analogies, really, these two, because this situation with the marriage doesn't seem to me that extreme. The key here, I think, is that the groom has given the instruction to the agent. If the agent, if the third party on his own went to a woman and said, I give you this money, you're married to Ploni, I don't think that would be Mekudeshet.
That's dangerous.
No. No. The groom doesn't say anything. The groom doesn't know the person.
He's not an
money.
Agent unless they
right.
have that.
Right. So in other words, it's not that. It's not really just a third party who's involved and he says, "Here's the money. Now you're married to Plumy." That would not be Mekudeshet. So this example is giving effect to what they seem to be saying, which is the two need to have an intent to marry.
Well, I wouldn't go too far with these things there because it's all we're not finished. You're taking it. You're getting too involved in the process. Hold on. Let's go further. I think what you are seeing the Gemara do is the Gemara is in a way taking our basic assumptions that we had, our simple assumptions, which. They turn out to be simplistic assumptions.
Yeah, they give daily
and pushing it farther to say simply what they're not. I don't think the point of this argument is to really settle for us any of these issues per se. That's not really where we're going. Because there's now yet a third case based on the prior two cases, without which we couldn't get to this third case unless we had the prior two cases. So in a way, what we've read so far is in a way a setup. It's a setup. And we've been set up now for yet a third case that we couldn't have imagined had we had not had the first two cases. So let's see what the third case is.
Just
right?
A quick one. Isn't this like the story of Eliezer and Rivka?
Maybe.
The agent?
Maybe. I'm not sure. All right, no, I want to go on. I want to see the third case. I'll read the English here. Rava has established from the law of the guarantor that a woman need not personally receive the money given for the kinyan of kiddushin. Right? That's the first thing that he established, the law of the guarantor. That in fact, even though we assumed she had to receive the money, she doesn't have to receive the money. Number one. Similarly, Rava has established from the law of the Canaanite slave that the man who betroths need not own the money for this kinyan. Those are the two things that we assumed. We assumed that he had owned the money and that she had to receive the money. What we have seen now is that, number one, he doesn't have to own the money and she doesn't have to receive the money. Okay? That's what the Gemara wants us to do. The Gemara. All right? Now, he presents a third ruling, which combines the principles established from the first two. Tain mane lifloni. If a woman says to a man, give a mane, give $100 to so-and-so. Right? She says to him, give $100 to so-and-so, and I will thereby become betrothed to him.
To him, not to you?
Right. To him. All right? She says to one man A, you give money to man B.
And I will marry B.
As a result of that, I marry B.
That's a good one.
Maybe it's her father.
Okay. Mikudeshet. Mikudeshet midin shnehem. This is a kosher transaction because of this combines both the principles that we just read. Shh, come on, you've got to concentrate on this. Got to concentrate. First of all, the first principle was guarantor. Right? The second principle was the Canaanite slave. Now let's see. Remember, we got to keep in mind what's going on here. A woman says, give money to so-and-so. Not give this money. Give money to so-and-so. And I will become betrothed to him, the recipient of the money. Right? This combines now the two principles. Let's see what it is. Arev, the principle of guarantor. Even though he does not personally receive the benefit of the money lent, does he not bind himself to repay the loan nonetheless?
Who's he, the one who gave it?
One man is giving money to another man, and she's married. That's originally, a man was supposed to give the money to the woman.
Correct.
Now, a man is giving money to another man.
And she married herself.
And she's married.
So how could that be?
But she's the same as getting the benefit of the woman.
She set it up.
Uh-huh.
It's similar to a case of a woman giving money.
She set it up. She set it up. She sets this up. But now, we assume that the guy who she's marrying actually has to do something, but he doesn't do anything at all.
He accepts the money.
He accepts the money. She, by setting it up, acts as the guarantor.
And the beneficiary. Right?
It couldn't have happened without her interference. She's the guarantor. The fact that this happens is such that the transaction never could have taken place. Because we learn the law of guarantor, we see that a guarantor is like a kinyan, and because in fact there is a kinyan, it's okay, in a way. But then there's a second side to it. But there's two sides. The second side is that she was supposed to be the beneficiary, and she didn't get anything.
Well, she got what
she
wanted.
But she gets in.
Okay.
She's married to the guy.
Correct. Just like the Canaanite slave. Two people can have a transaction between themselves. If, in fact, it's a benefit that you want to happen, and if, in effect, as a result of the prior reality, there's a guarantor here, then that's what she wants. It's like the Canaanite slave. Now, you'll see the way the Gemara works this out. Arev. Lavalgav de la kamate hana aliyah de kam mishab ed nafshe. A guarantor, even though he does not personally receive the benefit of the money lent, does he not bind himself to repay the loan nonetheless? Hai itatanami, this woman as well. Even though she does not personally receive the benefit of the money given, right? Kamaknaya nafsha. She gives herself over as a wife because there is a kinyan. There is a kinyan. All right? But Rava then observes that the principle, this principle alone would not suffice because of the following objection. Midame, are the cases truly comparable? Arev, in the case of a guarantor, Haide kakane leka chaser mamona, the one who acquires the services of the guarantor gives up some of his own money in the transaction. Okay, in a loan, a man who is benefiting from the guarantor is the creditor, because right? He knows he's going to get paid back by the guarantor, right? So he's giving something up, and the guarantor is providing a benefit for him, right? So, but he has to give something up, right? Hai gavra kakane la lahai idita. But in our case, this man acquires this woman as his wife, v'la kachaser v'lo mide, and he doesn't give up anything in the transaction. Right? He doesn't give up a thing. The case of the guarantor then does not suffice to prove that the kiddushin is valid. And the principle of the Canaanite slave now is introduced to restore the analogy. Eved kanani ochiach. That's why we need the principle of the Canaanite slave. The la kachaser mamona. For the slave doesn't give up any money in the emancipation transaction. V'kakane nafshe, and nevertheless he still acquires himself as a free man. So if you combine the two principles, then you can actually produce this transaction where the woman tells a guy to give money, one guy to give money to another money, another guy, the second guy, and in fact she marries the second guy even though she doesn't get any money and he doesn't give any money. Instead of giving, he gets. If you anticipated that before we got started, you're way ahead of me. You're way ahead of me.
I don't accept this one. and you still, you really don't know if the man who's going to be married even wants to get married.
No, that is.
Well, we have to assume that he does. We have to assume that he does.
Yeah, the intention is there, otherwise there would be no.
Right.
Okay, so someone had gambling debts. I mean, let's talk this through. Who had the gambling debt in this trio? The woman.
The groom.
The groom had the gambling debt.
Right. And the other guy paid it off.
Well, I would argue it could even be the other way around. That the second party had a gambling debt that the first woman had something to do with, and so she told him to pay the
I don't think it's gambling. I think it's a father and a son.
I think they're actually paying to get rid of their daughter.
Well, that was the first thing.
You've got a daughter that may not be marriageable, and yet you're giving the guy, someone is coming in from the family or whatever, giving this guy money, and then they get married.
It's a rich father who's a son who wants to marry to a certain woman, and she said, that's basically the deal.
Far be it from me to be as creative as you are in figuring out what actually is happening here. What interests me is that it's possible, not that you can't create the real conditions for it, but that this is legal. Because I knew what the law was to begin with. The Mishnah says that there are three ways to have kiddushin. Kesef, Shtar, and Bia. And we learned that Kesef is that the man has to give the woman money.
And
that's because of the analogy with Ephron the Hittite. Ephron the Hittite. So that I assumed that that's clear and that was simple and that's definitely what I had to happen. But obviously
Rava's
it's not so simple.
Us up.
Rava, by the time of the 4th century, I think that what this reflects probably is the highly sophisticated nature of commercial transactions. And I think that in any highly sophisticated society, somebody who is on the outside of the way in which transactions takes place, basically when you listen to them, you say, really? You could do things like that? When people like me, for example, hear about these different types of debt instruments, that people have and people are making lots of money on, I listen to it for a minute and I say, duh, I guess so. I mean, somebody who understands this better than I guess knows what's going on here, and I guess it seems to be legal, or sometimes it's legal, or maybe it's legal, and you know, it seems to work. Highly sophisticated economies can produce the strangest transactions, and in fact, they're legal. And I think that what one is seeing here is, in a way, the elaboration, in a very theoretical way. I have no idea how practical this is, and maybe it's practical, but it doesn't have to be practical. We see the elaboration of commercial law, and a lot of what this chapter is going to be dealing with is, in fact, the laws of Kenyon. A lot of the laws of commercial transactions come from this first chapter of Kiddushin. Simply because once you begin to get into the issues, in effect they're applicable in a variety of areas. And because the Mishnah itself has set it up as a transaction, it has created the basis of analogy to a commercial transaction of property that's in the Torah. Then in effect, in the sophisticated society, you can take any of the specific instances and sort of push them to their limits and to see what's possible. And in fact, once you begin to do that, you create possibilities that are, for want of a better word, creative. It's like sophisticated creative monetary instruments, of which there apparently are many.
Do you know if at that time they had transaction on certain, a taxation on a certain transaction?
As far as I know, they did not.
Because at the early time of Israel, when Israel had an estate tax in the first few years.
The state of Israel.
State of Israel, yeah. They had an estate tax, and what they did, if somebody was on his way out, if his son came to him, to avoid the estate tax, if his son came to him and say, the father said to the son, I want you to name your son on my name and I will give you my estate, that means that he bought the benefit of the name of the future son, and that was cleared of the estate tax.
Mm-hmm. Well, something like that we do every...
There was a transaction and it wasn't really an estate because it was prior to his real death. Mm-hmm. It was like... So then there is no estate tax anymore in Israel, but at that
that's
time,
one way to get rid of this problem, right?
Right. Right. So that was, you know, and it came to the point that even if people had two witnesses after he died, so-called witnesses, then it was a transaction. Mm-hmm. And that were a lot of people. So I wonder if they establish a Kenyan system to avoid certain things that the melech of that country, which is not our country, mm-hmm. so they try to avoid. And it's just not written here.
It's possible, but I don't think that it's actually necessary, because I think even in our own free society, where we have a very complicated economy, the possibility that you will push commercial transactions to their either logical or creative end, you'll create all kinds of possibilities, happens every day as far as I can see. Mm-hmm. It just depends upon how creative people are, how much capital they have at their disposal, and all kinds of things happen. So you may be right, but I don't know that that's a necessary precondition for this kind of thinking to take place. It's one condition, but it may be one of many. Yes?
Irrespective of all the elucidations on the various possibilities, the fact is that it points out that the acquisition of a wife cannot be equated with commercial transaction.
Really?
Why?
It is.
Because there are exceptions to it.
I don't know that we've established that here, because all our analogies here are to commercial transactions, I think. So the only thing that we did say that I think would support that is that you can't acquire a woman, a wife, for chalipin, for that kinyan sudar, that in that way it's different from commercial transactions. But I think these other analogies are analogous to commercial transactions, whatever they are.
I think I'm understanding what you said, and it's kind of interesting because they started out with something that was very direct and very simple. They really gave you a really minimal amount. People who were poor could afford 2 pennies at some point. It wasn't discriminatory as to who could get married. You didn't need huge dowries. You could get married for 2 cents. You could get married. But then I think what you're saying, or what I'm getting from this, is that it got to be such a sophisticated monetary society that they used marriage as a way to play out some of their money issues in a sophisticated way. So that as they were doing this in other commercial areas, they were figuring out ways that more money could be involved with the act of marriage, because you don't really need to have 100 money or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I just can't say for sure. I think a lot of this is totally theoretical. I mean, my reaction to it is that it has very little relation to reality to begin with, because it seems to me the law still is shteputot. All you need are 2 cents. So it's not as if you really need any of these things, and everybody, that law hasn't changed.
But
yeah, but you cannot redeem a slave with 2 prutot. That's the problem.
We're not talking about, we're only learning from the law of slaves. We're creating certain theoretical questions about a transaction. And we're in order to help us know whether in fact the nature of a transaction is that in fact money has to pass from the hands of one person to another. And in commercial law, that's a very interesting and an important question to be able to answer. And in fact, in commercial transactions, money does not have to pass from the hands of one person to another. There are a million different things that can happen that can make a transaction happen. And I think that that's true here as it is anywhere else. That having been said, I can't imagine, for practical reasons, that the law really functions any differently than it functions today, because it's so simple. Why create a far more complicated practical reality than a simple one? Why would a complicated reality really function better than a simple reality? That's the way I read.
More money involved, and they may have used this, I thought you were saying, as a springboard for other.
For shidduch, it was, I think.
I'm not sure. I'm putting all of that at arm's length. I think that this is entirely theoretical.
Just theoretical.
And it really leads to, it had nothing to do with marriage, frankly. It has to do with commercial transactions.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
And it has to, and it doesn't mean that marriage, in fact, would be done as this is discussing, even though maybe it could have been done that way, simply because it's so much easier to do it another way. And it is so simple and so small. I'm sorry.
Well, I like to think this is about marriage, but maybe what you were saying earlier about people being away, or living in different villages and being physically separate.
Right.
What I was thinking is it would be a solution for that problem.
That's true.
So let's say that, you know, in the case of the guarantor, or the case of the proxy, whatever, the you know, there it's easy. That
let's say
a man
agent
wants to become engaged or betrothed to a woman, and he's not there. Maybe he's got competition, so he's allowed to have someone not
That's
even
true.
Use his own money.
Yep.
But then maybe she's far away, and
so he can give it to somebody.
Exactly.
Two
and
people can give, right?
Right,
yeah,
with
I
her
don't
permission.
Think they can
so
fulfill
maybe it's
their contract because they've got, you know, obligations that being long distance, and I don't know how that.
I mean, sex is tough like that.
Seems that way. I don't know, but
it would
seem that way.
But Elaine, I think your point is well taken. I mean, I think that that reality is certainly possible.
Because the amount of money required is so small, it's hard to believe that that would be useful.
Right. It can't be that would have been the issue.
Right.
Right. It could be, to the extent that this is practical, that there were other issues like two people being in the same town or in the same county or the same country, or, you know, there could be issues like
both
that.
Both of them being Jews.
It was a clearance house.
Well, no, that's easy. They both have to be Jews.
No.
What?
It reaffirms the assurance that both of them are Jews.
Well, that's, the law wouldn't apply otherwise, definitely.
This is the Talmud.
Right.
Yes.
If kesef literally means money, it seems that what we're talking about here is something, for example, the issue of the guarantor, it's more than money. That kesef, it should be merely obligation or a benefit, I should say, mm-hmm. that a woman receives an ultimate benefit rather than a woman receiving money.
Mm-hmm.
If kesef means money, it seems like it might not really be describing the broad type of benefits that is part of kiddushin.
I understand. No, that's a good point. And I just remind you that the Mishnah went in the first Mishnah, Aisha niknet v'shalosh drachim v'kona tatzma v'shtei drachim. A woman is acquired through three ways, and she acquires herself in two ways. At niknet b'kesef b'shtar o b'ya, she is acquired through kesef, a document or b'ya, b'chesef. Then it says, with kesef, Beit Shammai omrim, b'dinar uveshaveh dinar. With a dinar or with the equivalent of. That's the key phrase, equivalent of.
But that equivalent means broadly benefit.
Exactly, exactly.
I thought it meant a ring.
Pardon me?
I thought it meant a ring.
But the truth is you're both right. I mean, it means some broadly conceived benefit, perhaps, or could mean a ring, could mean any of these things.
I mean, because the guarantor situation here is a very broad benefit.
Exactly, exactly. Correct. That's totally in the realm of benefit. If that's the way to think of it, which I think, by the way, look at English note number 4. There's a very, very good note here, number 4, that discusses the guarantor. In reference to both kiddushin and guaranteeing a loan, an act of kinyan must be performed to make the transaction of the obligation binding. Rava therefore makes the following analogy. In the case of the guarantor, we find that the transfer of money on the guarantor, say so, serves as a kinyan. Okay? At the moment the borrower accepts the loan, the guarantor becomes obligated to repay it in the case of default. Right? The guarantor himself, however, need not receive any money to effect the kinyan. So too, then, the same should apply with kiddushin. The transfer of money on the woman's say so should suffice as a kinyan to betroth her, and it should not be necessary that she herself receive this money. Right? That's simply using the concept of guarantor as the analogy between the situation of the woman here and the situation of the guarantor to a loan. Now, he then goes into some of the Rishonim, the early commentators, who sort of modify this somewhat, this understanding somewhat. In explaining the above principles, Ritva notes that although the guarantor does not receive the money of the loan per se, he nevertheless receives a measure of benefit in the transaction. Ritva wants to raise another issue, and that's the issue of benefit. Because what the English note has said so far is that the analogy is simply between two people who function to make a transaction able to happen, and that's their common thread, the guarantor and the woman here. Okay? Mm-hmm. They make it happen, and therefore it's a kinyan. It's a kinyan. So Ritva says, no, there's more to it than that. There's actually an issue of benefit. Because remember, this I'm coming back to your point, Mil, that if it's shaveh kesef, if it's the equivalent of money, then we're talking in the realm of benefits, that there's a benefit. So then we want to know, well, what is the benefit that the guarantor is getting? So, and that's what Ritva talks about. Ritva wants to find some benefit here, because then that'll make sense in terms of our original Mishnah, that she'll be receiving a benefit. If the guarantor gets, if we can show that the guarantor gets a benefit, we can show she gets a benefit. Mm-hmm. And that can be, every benefit has a monetary value to it. So he says, Ritva notes that although the guarantor does not receive the money of the loan per se, he nevertheless receives a measure of benefit in the transaction. For the lender has trusted him to lend money on his word. It is this benefit, Ritva asserts, which serves in lieu of money as an instrument of kinyan. It's the benefit, the guarantor gets a benefit. It's a benefit of trust. And that you were saying before, it helps his reputation. It increases his significance in the eyes of other people. I'd say he gets trust. In effect, it's that benefit that's conferred upon him that is the effective thing here. Right? It is this benefit, Ritva asserts, which serves in lieu of money as an instrument of kinyan. By accepting it, accepting the benefit, the guarantor binds himself to repay the loan. The same is true for kiddushin. The woman receives a measure of benefit in that her suitor has seen fit to give money on her say-so. And it is this benefit which serves in place of the money of kiddushin. That's a different, slightly different angle, but trying to look at it with the emphasis on the concept of benefit. Thirdly, is a third view here of Tosafot. The Tosafot say, Tosafot, however, indicate that the instrument which obligates the guarantor is the actual money of the loan. The instrument that obligates the guarantor is the actual money of the loan. According to Tosafot, the Torah views the borrower's acceptance of the loan as if the guarantor had accepted this very money himself and with it obligated himself to repay. So it's an as if. The guarantor, because the guarantor makes it happen, it's as if he accepts the money himself. But in fact, somebody else is getting it. But it's as if he does, because that's why he's obligated to pay it back. So it's an as-if kind of arrangement. In reference to Kiddushin, it thus follows that when the person designated by the woman accepts the money, we view this as if she herself had accepted it. Because she designates someone else, it's another as-if. It's as if she accepts, as if the guarantor accepts the money, that's the power of the guarantor. As is if the woman accepts the money, that's the power of the woman in the transaction. So there are different possibilities here to define what the common thread is between the guarantor and the woman. It's not just one possibility. Okay?
I wonder if someone...
Isn't there a problem, though, with the third example of Rava where, I mean, this makes sense whether you're measuring it in terms of benefit or an actual strictly looking at the legal obligation, so just by virtue of guaranteeing the loan, she's essentially accepting the loan,
mm-hmm.
is obligated. In the third example of Rava, see, let's say Ritva says the benefit that the suitor has seen fit to give money on her say-so. In the third example, the person who gives the money is not the suitor. The recipient of the money is the suitor. What does the bride takes on the same obligation? So she has the same, whether it's a benefit that on her say-so the man gave the money to the third party, or that she simply has a legal obligation somehow because by virtue of his having acted, she's taken on a change in status. Now she's committed some way to somebody, but she winds up committed to the wrong person. Since the whole discussion here was introduced with a series of arguments that Rava made about giving something with the understanding it will be returned to you is not actually, the transaction is never valid, blah, blah, and then it's suddenly, Rav Ashi comes in and says, no, there's no problem here because actually Rava was completely misquoted from day one and what he really
in that previous
thing. So now we've gone on with more of his argument. The whole thing seems to have gone very far away. Dan pointed out we learned earlier that if the woman says, I'm betrothing myself to you, that's not bad. It's not the Mekudeshet. So here we have a case of that. In the case of the agent, whether he used his own money or something, the groom never gets to say to her, Ariat Mekudeshetli, or any other variation. So there's somehow, I find the whole thing a little bit, maybe that eventually it'll...
That's not going to, it won't resolve itself to your satisfaction.
So it's just a kind of a game they're playing. How far can we push this? Never mind what we said earlier.
Well, you know that I agree with you. Keep in mind that the second issue, remember there were two, just to fill out what you're saying here, in Rava's third example, he needed both the case of the guarantor and the Canaanite slave in order to be able to prove that this woman is Mekudeshet. One, either one by itself, would not have yielded that. You needed a combination of the two in order to yield that. And it's only with a combination of the two that
you
can.
You could have used the whole, he could have used this as an argument to say this is not valid, not because even if we bring in the argument of the guarantor or we bring in the argument of the Eved Kanani, it just simply doesn't
but
hold
that's,
up.
That was the key. That's why I tried to say before that I wouldn't get hung up on those first two arguments, because those first two arguments exist in order to get to the third argument. They really exist in order to get their stepping stones to this third, to the more complicated and the much less intuitive, the least intuitive of all of the situations. And I think that the purpose of doing this is to create, to push the bounds again, and to say that what in fact will work is not necessarily at all what's intuitive. And that if we take a series of examples, we'll be able to go to from example B to example A to example B to example C. And we may be very surprised when we get to C, but if A worked and B works, then C will conceivably work as well. And I think that all of this is just the flow of logic, and I'm not at all sure how practical it is. I think a lot of it is, I don't want to call it games playing, but it's not something too far away from that. It's the games playing that philosophers do and that lawyers do. Or that people, at least people in law school do it. I don't know whether actual lawyers do it. You lawyers can tell me
well,
that.
There is a need for
but people in, surely when you are working out the nature of a code or the nature of a system, this is the kind of stuff that it seems to me it's natural to do.
It obliges people to think.
You know, in the first and third cases, the guarantor, when she gives money to, directs money to a future husband, you can look at it as the benefit to the wife in both of those instances is that she's getting people to move. She's getting people to change their status.
Right.
And the first time she's getting somebody to give money to somebody else, so she's sort of causing action.
Like a
guarantor. That could be a benefit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could look at it, you might look at it
that
way.
That's good. That's another possibility. Good.
Do we have polygamy at this point, or is this monogamy?
Well, there in theory was polygamy. Polygamy was not outlawed, but basically of a monogamous society. Why?
I don't know whether it had any practical ramifications for what was happening socially, whether there was a change in the ratio of men and women or anything like that, that, you know, maybe there was a reason to expand it a little bit and to make it a little bit broader at that point in time. So that's all I'm asking, whether or not there was any change in something about the balance of men and women or the way marriage had been.
Depends when.
My theory still is that, as far as I know, I don't know of any evidence for that. As far as we know, by that time, it's pretty much a monogamous society. Don't know anything about the numbers, the relative numbers of men and women. I can't think of anything that would teach us that. My sense is that, again, that this is part of the society that has a sophisticated economic perspective to it.
Yeah,
and that's what we are seeing here.
It allowed... Like Jerusalem and Persia, it's allowed to have transaction between families to marry without really move money from A to B. You can say, Joe, give money to A, and she will marry him.
And just as you do that,
the Rothschild family built their empire like that by being in five cities over Europe.
I would imagine that all of this happens in particular, and the laws probably develop themselves practically more than from the women, but from the wheat or the beged, the pieces of cloth. Mm-hmm. in that we know there are trades internationally, commonly, and the sophisticated society develops the means to create those types of transactions. And when it becomes very sophisticated, even money itself, the trend, just the value of money, let's say, I mean, that's another one of those things which I'm, some of you, I'm sure, are very sophisticated in. I certainly don't take that to myself. But simply the value of money, that people will sit at a screen and they see that, that money goes up and down in value so that they make money from selling money. You know, to you it's obvious. Of course.
By the way, it's called
Shar Chalipin.
Shar Chalipin.
That's
exactly the same.
So, so all of these things that happen in a sophisticated society, I think one sees the reality of that in this kind of literature. And I think that to the extent that marriage is analogous, because the Mishnah sets it up as something which involves a kinyan, and where kesef is involved, that simply it's all wrapped up together. I don't claim anything more than that. If I could be correct in claiming even that, I will have made my peace. Any other questions?
Yes. You said last time that we are trying not to have a kinyan of a wife parallel to transaction of material. And here it's basically...
This one is an awful lot like it. I'll admit that.
It's very
exactly, it's commercial transactions. To be continued.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Getting married is very,
very
complicated.
Dumb.
I would say you should alone.
Just find the woman that will...